Mr. Bobby Hume,
let's do it.
Welcome to the show.
Brother, it's good to be here. I know this has been a long time coming. It's great to see you, man.
Great to see you, man. So before we jump into things, can you just give yourself a brief introduction of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Bobby Humes. I'm an executive career coach and consultant. I help leaders and teams all across the country and the globe meet their goals, get out of their own way, and find their possible.
I love that get out of their own way. So I've certainly seen it firsthand. Some of the magic that you've been able to do.
Thank you.
I want to talk about your journey though. Before we get into like everything that you're doing right now, let's talk about the career journey of Coach Bobby Humes. Yeah. Where are you from originally? How'd you grow up? What was the formative years look like?
Yeah, man. I'm originally from Long Beach, California, on the north side. And so I grew up in the 80s, man. So there was a lot of gang activity at that time. I grew up in a gang affiliate household. And my mom decided after going to church and giving her life to a Christ to start a business. And her moving to start that business put us in the suburbs, like overnight almost, and put me on this trajectory towards what I thought was going to be the University of Southern California. I don't know what I was going to do there, but I just knew I wanted to get into USC. But my childhood was really good, man. Like it was one of those things where, you know, I didn't know I was poor until we moved into the suburbs and I realized, oh, you can have two houses. Like, I mean, sorry, you can have two cars for one house. Or, you know, wow, kids are getting shoes all the time. Just some things that I didn't have access to, like sports and things like that because of the cost of them. But mom always made a way. And it was like that grit and determination that she showed as an entrepreneur then that I can lean back and appreciate now. Like, and so, at 17, I joined the Army. And that sent me all around the world. I learned a lot about myself and about others. And about this thing we call humanity, got to see that displayed. Did a lot of peacekeeping missions. So I was in Bosnia, in the late 90s. And then, did a tour in Korea and then also did a tour in Mosul, Iraq. And again, learning how to work with different people from all over, you know, from different backgrounds, from different political affiliations and working with them to do good things. That's kind of what I'm into now. That's why I kind of lean into those difficult, hard situations where teams and leaders, are struggling. But that's really the Reader's Digest version of my early years, man. A lot of discovery, a lot of change and nuance, and a lot of grit and determination, for sure.
What was the decision to join the Army? Did you have or the military? Was there people in your sphere that were doing that? Like, how did you come to that decision?
Well, I came to the Army because I didn't know that you had to pay for college. I thought if you had good enough grades that they just let you in, just on a sheer personality. But I was in a critical inflection point. Right? Do I stay and work this job? I was working a warehouse job at the time. Packing cribs and boxes and crates and pallets and putting them on to trains. Like, was I going to stay doing that or was I going to try to take things into my own hands? And so the Army was offering me school. It was an option there. I was in ROTC in high school. You know, the kids who's walking through the school wearing the uniform. I was doing that. So I knew it was a viable option to me just because it was a class that I took in high school. And really excelled at the extracurricular parts of it, traveling, doing drill competitions, all those kind of things. Was really into that kind of stuff. So I knew that the Army was an option. I also have an uncle who was in the Army, but he was in during the Gulf War, and his experience wasn't that great. So there was a lot of warning signs from my family, like, don't do this, don't do this. The expectation for me was that I was going to be a doctor. You know, I have an aunt who's a pediatrician. She's awesome, man. She went to Duke and UCLA at the same time. I don't know how she did that, but she made it work. She just sold her practice, a long time practice in the Virginia area. But that was my expectation. She's the matriarch of our family, and my expectation was to be a doctor. And I realized early on in my life, I don't like blood or other things that come out of the human body, so that wasn't going to work for me. And so the Army was great, man. It taught me that I was an entrepreneur, because people assume that in the military you're a some type of mindless robot. You're not. You're given a lot of you're empowered to make a lot of decisions and to work with those around you to solve complex problems. And I thrived in that environment. So yeah.
And so that decision making process in the Army and what they're teaching you, do you found that a lot of the tools that you learned at that time helped you further on in your career? I mean, did they train you on how to make decisions, even though they gave you the autonomy?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So the military has a very regimented decision-making structure. Like, what's the issue? Like, first, let's take the issue and let's really look at it. Whether the issue is an enemy combatant, or it is a difficult terrain, or a brand new population that we need to get to know to do our peacekeeping pieces, right? And they, you know, there's a lot of common sense ingenuity that comes with that. Like, who, what, where, why, who, what, when, where, why, how. You know, just breaking things down to the lowest common denominator. And one of the things we used to say in the Army is, if the privates, if the folks who are lowest in the Army can't understand what we're doing, we probably shouldn't do it. Because everybody needs to be able to embrace what we're doing, see themselves in what we're doing, and execute their piece of what we're trying to accomplish. These are things that I use today when I'm working with clients and they have a complex problem. I might listen one way to the CEOs. I'm going to listen totally different than the people who are boots on the ground, touching that widget every day, working that service line every day, because they're going to have a different data set that we can take and use in how we put together what we might use as our, you know, our intervention or our solution set to that problem. It really takes everyone's vantage point looking at something in order to understand it, and then to see what's possible in executing, moving things forward. And so that definitely is something that I use. I use it in my home with my boys as well. Like, you know, you have, you know, not always having the answer for them, but helping guide them through a thought process that's going to help them land on that answer, because that's going to be more beneficial for them in the long run if dad is not the only sage in the house, right? Have them dial into that inner wisdom.
Yeah. As in, the truth is there. Let's help you find the tools and the things that you can find available to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When did you become a coach? Can you walk us through your career path and how you came to this as what you do?
Yeah. So in the Army, I was a personnel specialist, and I did a lot of training and design. And I learned that I was good at being in front of people and helping them like learn nuances of different ways of looking at things. And so that I carried that out of the military into grad school, into a degree in human resources, where I get to work with people systems all the time. And it really scratches my curiosity bug. And so I ended up in a really interesting way as the chief HR officer of the city of Seattle, right before COVID and during half of COVID, right? And so at the beginning, it was all, you know, rainbows and Skittles. It was great because there wasn't this huge 100-year virus that was destroying people's lives. And I was building things, right? Citywide policies. I was helping the HR focus of the city be more aligned to the race and social justice values that the city had. And I was just building really cool things. And then when COVID hit, really had this, this challenge of, you know, who am I? What am I doing? And just before COVID, someone thought it would be wise to send the mayor at the time anonymous letters about me, saying, well, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's inexperienced. You know, how did he get here? And it shook me. No one has ever spent their time and put a letter in the mail to attack me. That's never happened to me. So it shook me, man. It kind of made me, you know, think that I had to watch my back. And that's not how I move. And so I knew enough about coaching to go to my boss at the time and say, you know, I need some support. I can't get my creative juices aren't flowing. I'm down on myself a lot. I need some help. And so I did two things. I went to him and said that, and I got a therapist. And in my coaching, I learned that, okay, there's not a big, massive change that I as a human need to make. There's small incremental things that I can do, and I can test those things out over time, gather some more data, similarly to what we do in the military, and then make some decisions based on that new data. And as I continue to do that, well, now these problems that I thought were so large are really very accessible. And I realize I do have some inner wisdom that I can use to navigate these things. And one of the lessons I took from my therapist was he made me write all of my successes on sticky notes and put them on my wall. He said, everything that you've ever thought was going to fail, but you succeeded, make a sticky and put that up. And I did that, had a whole bunch. And he said, count them. And I counted them. And then he said, of all those successes, why would that stop now? And it was just that mind blowing. And just having two people who were able to sit in these spaces of helping me, just not to give me answers, but just to bounce things off of and kind of sit with, I just made up my mind that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my adult life. That's what I want to do for people. And so I told my coach, who's now my mentor and friend, hey, I want to do what you do. And she turned me on to the Hudson Institute of Coaching. And the Hudson Institute of Coaching is a long time coaching influencer in the field, and has shaped a lot of the practices that we use across coaching that have been adopted by the International Coaching Federation. And when I got to Hudson, I realized that it was going to take a lot. You know, it was 8 months, and I think like 40, 50 books, but just a lot of learning into things that seem easy but are very complex, like the simplicity of just listening to someone, not having all the answers, not having a program for them to do. Okay, here are the four steps that you do to be a better leader, but really listening to where they're at. And what they want to bring about in answering the question of what makes them a better leader, and in helping them continue to define that and get clarity on and test out things. It's amazing what you can do as a coach and what I get from coaching. Like every one of my clients teaches me something about the world, because they're so vast and different industries and do different things. And about myself, some clients are really easy for me to listen to, and some are not, right? And so why is that, right? And so it's been this really cool intellectual, spiritual, if you will, journey around how do I help people be better and just lean into being their best selves. And I found coaching because I was in crisis. And so I look for clients who are in similar cases, or look for clients who are entrepreneurial, look for clients who want to shape a better world.
What's been the biggest surprise of all those things? I mean, I have a ton of questions for you on this, but what's the biggest thing going into this that you were saying like, oh, I didn't expect that to be a part of this or the big part, like good or bad?
Is there anything that stands out? Yeah. Neuroscience to me, like the way our brains work and the way that our brains are line up with these habits that are really neural pathways, like that are really, you know, at one time, you know, one behavior might have been set to help you navigate something that you were dealing with as a youth, but you don't need that same behavior now that you're managing, you know, a Fortune, you know, 100 company. You need a different set of skills, or maybe you need some elements of that behavior, but not all of it. And so really just diving into how our brains work, and how we can trick our brain into rewiring itself, that our brains are, malleable, you know, and we can, you know, and I really got into aging. Like we don't know a lot about, you know, what happens over time as we age. And I'm really into that. So really, I thought coaching was going to be, okay, people show up, I tell them what I think, and they go away. And what it really is helping people go on journeys, right? And realize that, you know, we're complex creatures and we're all in this transition. We're all making transition after transition. And that's really what it's about. I thought it was going to be a lot harder. And please don't get me wrong. Coaching is challenging work. It is not just hanging up a shingle saying, all right, I'm open. A lot of harm can happen if the coach isn't grounded in some ethical standard and some methodology and some framework. But that framework is really anti what we believe it is. I think people, when they come to me, want me to tell them exactly what to do. And some people get frustrated when I say, well, what do you think? You know, let's take that example that, or this problem that you have, and, you know, what's really at the root of it? Like, what's really going on there? I don't know, Bobby, that's why I'm talking to you. We just stare at each other. Like, I don't know either. It's your life. Like, like, what are we going to do about it? And so I thought it was going to be a lot of answering questions. It's really learning over and over again to sit with people. And for me, not solve their problems, because I'm a problem solver. Ask my wife. She would tell you, yeah, that brother likes to solve a problem. and what I get to do in coaching is just really sit and listen and just be with people.
So that sounds like the be with people and sit with them is something that you expected or you saw originally or in your initial stages, but the science piece of like, oh wow, this is science. Like, I'm a scientist now, I guess. Yeah. In certain ways.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm a scientist, but I am. I wouldn't mind getting a PhD in neuroscience at some point. It's fascinating what we don't know about how our brains work.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things, and maybe you wouldn't have that same level of interest if you hadn't gone through that first door.
Oh, absolutely, you know? Not.
Absolutely, and that not. And so that aspect of leaning into your curiosity and the things of like, oh, I like this, let me take another step forward, is something that's so fascinating to me and so amazing about all this journey. And like you said, it can be simple, but it's complex. So yeah. There's going to be challenges, but there's some beautiful things that happen along that journey.
Absolutely.
So in your work with coaching, is there anything that you draw back from like your childhood? Cause you mentioned a couple things that, you know, when you moved, you know, you were like, oh, this is something new. And like, this is something, a different way of thinking that working with clients and things, is there anything that you think back now into your upbringing, childhood that you can reflect on now that's part of your process of what you're building on now?
Mm-hmm. Good question. You know, at Hutton, they teach us that every coach has a signature presence. Just every coach brings their nuanced way of looking at what the client is up to and their own way of helping the client navigate through things. And I think that growing up where I grew up, it was very diverse. I would say that, Black, white, Samoan, one of the largest contingents of people outside of the country of Cambodia in North Long Beach. Those folks shaped my world. And so I think that when I show up with clients, I'm really curious about them, right? I'm curious about what, you know, I mean, I ask this question, it may not ever get there, but I'm curious, you know, what are your favorite foods? You know, what are your family traditions? Because I was exposed to so much of that. And so I'm really... I believe part of my signature presence is able to connect with people, no matter what backgrounds they come from. Because in high school, it flipped. It was mostly predominantly white, and it was folks who had affluence and influence, and that was at first off-putting, but very quickly, I found my way of how to navigate that, and so. I think I'm a social chameleon in that way without giving away of myself and who I truly am. You drop me anywhere and I think I'll figure it out. I'll figure out how to eat the food. I'll learn, you know, the parts of the language that I need to help me move and do what I got to do. And I think that's what I bring to my sessions. Like, no matter what region you're from, what background you're from, I'm going to help you create a space that you can be. And, that's what I'd say.
That's powerful.
Thank you, brother.
I want to make sure that we also cover something I know is big in your life, and that's music.
Yeah, man.
You haven't mentioned. I know it's huge for you, but you haven't mentioned it yet. So I want to talk about.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your musical journey. Like, tell me about how you were first introduced to music and all the different things that you've done. I know, and all this has to influence who you are as a person and how you coach. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So music, if you know, I have music on my arm. It's like music's in my DNA, right? Like, though there's a piano on my arm, I don't read music. I play all by ear. I play the piano. I play a little bit of bass. I play drums. I play a little bit of guitar, but mostly I'm a vocalist and a writer. I started playing music at about the age of 13. My mom, like I said, you know, she changed our life radically when she dedicated her life to a Christ. That put me in this church community, and I was like, okay, that's lame. But when she started making me go to church, it was one of those church communities where they were big on you have a gift and we're going to figure out what that is. And so we had a dance team and we had a drama team and we had, you know, a orchestra. And so I wanted to do all those things. And so, I told the pastor of the church, I wanted to play an instrument. He gave me a flute and I was like, I don't know if this is the instrument I want to play, but brother, like. I learned to play that flute in 1 week. Like I knew the scales. I knew how to hold it. I knew how to do like different runs on it in about a week. And if you know anything about the flute and the fingerings, it's the same as a saxophone. So after a month, I was playing flute and the sax, writing my own songs. A kid next door to me also went to our church as well. And he had this old Casio keyboard. And I said, can I have that? And then I started like learning how to play keyboard. Fast forward into high school, I ended up becoming the assistant drum major without reading music. But because I was in ROTC, I could spin a mace. That's the big stick that the drum major carries. And when I had it to conduct, I would go to the music store and buy the albums. And I'd listen to the albums and learn all the timing signature of the album so that when I came to school, I didn't have to read the music. I could just hear. Some people might say that's lazy. I say it's efficient because I wasn't going to be a music major. I just love music. I think it's a powerful tool and a resource for us. And so when I got into the Army, I started making beats. So I would have people come to my room, and I'd be making beats, and I'd have people like freestyling all around that while I was doing that thing. I would do vocal lessons in my Army room, and just always doing something. And then when I got out of the Army, I dropped a couple mixtapes. You know, I always got something to say. So always producing, always writing. And today, at one time I was the music director for a church. We wrote some original songs. I love teaching music, not necessarily like this is what you do, because I don't have any music theory background, but that energy and the performance element of what it should look like when you're really leaning into what you're doing. I'm just big on that. And so today I'm still a part of a worship team at my church. Hopefully we'll get to a point where we can start writing our own songs as well. 'Cause I got a lot of ideas, but I got a whole studio at my house, man. Like I got all the things that you need. And, I have a 5-year-old son. I have 5 boys, and my 5-year-old, I think he's caught the music bug. I heard him singing the other day. He's got perfect pitch. And he's definitely a ham. So he'll have that performance element about him. We had him in piano lessons, but that probably didn't go well. We'll try again. But yeah, music is huge. I start my day with at least some lo-fi hip hop. By midday, I'm into some like lo-fi jazz, and then by the end of the day, I'm playing, you know, if it's not you know, like some punk rock, then it's some like old school funk. Or, you know, just, I'm all across the board. I even have there's a Apple playlist called Classical Bangers. And it's just all like the top rated classical music. And it's just a great way to kind of mix up the flow, change the energy. Yeah, music's a big thing. And you are too, right? You got some musicians in your crib as well.
Yeah. Surprisingly so. Well, No, not surprisingly so. Music's such a big part of our life, but I never really trained in music. I play guitar. I played guitar for 13 years now. And never took a lesson. You know, I had to watch some YouTube videos, but knowing how much I love music, we've always had it playing in our house in all different types of genres. And yeah, it's a big part of our life. So now to hear my kids, our kids, you know, my wife and I, our kids play instruments. They both play guitar, and my daughter also plays piano. And it's just a joy to hear them playing. And it's getting better and better. Like at first, it's I'm glad they're playing, but I just wish it sounded a little better.
I wish it was better. Keep working.
But now it's, and know what else is really interesting about this is that I hear I'm bored so much less frequently. Because they've heard me say so many times, like, hey, if you're bored, I know you have a guitar in your room. I know you have two guitars in your room. I know you have a piano downstairs, a keyboard downstairs.
Go get those finger pads.
I don't hear I'm bored that often. So that's been good. But yeah, we absolutely love it. Music's such a big part of our lives. It's the rhythm of life, you know? And you know, one thing that I find really strange is when you go to a party or somebody's house and they're having a get together, and there's no music. And
there's no music. It's weird.
It's a weird thing. It's like, weird. I mean, and you can still have a good time and a good vibe, but without setting that tempo for everyone to be on that level, it's weird.
It's something that we do when I consult and I travel the country, you know, helping organizations move their needle, whatever that might be. I'm coming to the room. I need to get in there at least 2 hours before. I'm picking that music selection. I might change some seats around. I might walk around, and I'm just going to make that place mine. By the time folks are coming in, I'm at that front door, you know, giving them fist bumps, welcoming them to that space. And you got some lo-fi jazz going, and I always hear somebody, "Ooh, this sounds nice. What is this?" Right? It's like, "Oh, that's music. That's some lo-fi music, just to bring us into a space. This is a learning space. This is a creative space. So I want to make sure it has that tone, so that we can all flow in that way."
That's
again,
great.
It's so, neuroscience there, right?
Yeah, and so that's a great point, especially because the show, like Tools, Talents, and Techniques, that's definitely a tool, a technique.
Use that.
Is there anything else that you found to be successful, or something that you do in your day-to-day, your plants and your coaching, something that you implement that gives you, I won't say an advantage, but something that's unique in your approach?
Yeah, I would say I use the Monday.com tool. So if you don't know about Monday.com, it's like your Asana or, you know, one of those project management tools, your, you know, efficiency management tools. And I touch that thing for 1 hour every Sunday, starts my week out, and I'm just in there organizing things, setting up due dates for myself, so that I can move my life forward. And so I think sometimes we treat life like a sailboat, right? We get into the boat, we cast ourselves out, and then we put the sail up, and whatever way the wind blows, there we are. And I lived my life like that for my first 28 years. And then I got to the point where, well, there's actually a place I want to be. Like I want to actually arrive at a specific beach, and it has a specific, you know, real estate on it. And there's a smell that I want. There's some specificity in what I'm trying to achieve. And so I want an outboard motor in my boat. I don't want to sail up. And so for me, Monday.com is a part of my outboard motor. It lets me set my direction, lets me chart where I want to be. And then I got data to look back at my week that next Sunday and say, I didn't get to that. And maybe if I got a great coach, I might ask myself, well, why? Why didn't I get to that? Or, you know, or maybe I just give myself grace that I didn't overload myself. You know, maybe I didn't get to it because I took some time to myself or to my family or to something or to serve someone else. And so that would be the tool that I use, you know, most right now. And then there's a book, and do I have it with me? I don't have it with me. The book is called Humble Inquiry. Humble Inquiry is the book. It was written by a Stanford professor whose name escapes me right now. I'm sure some of your listeners are like, I know that book. The book kind of thumbs its nose at the premise that in communication, we need to be, not what I'm doing right now, talkers, right? But we need to sit and listen. The book starts out with this person who's tending his garden, and a woman comes up, and before she asks any questions, she just starts telling the writer what to do. But if she had asked some questions, if she had done some inquiry, she would have realized that the guidance that she's giving isn't the guidance that is best for him in what he's doing. And I think we do that a lot in Western culture, that we have a lot to say, but we're not really sitting with, I wonder what's going on here. Like, let's ask some questions. Again, going back to that army thing, how do we increase the aperture of the data set so we can see all the different pieces and then maybe offer something to say? But oftentimes I'm learning these days that I want to ask more questions than I want to do telling. And that book really gives you a crash course into how to do that well.
Okay. I'm going to make sure to put this in the show notes, but also get it myself and take a look.
Yeah,
great.
Let me know what you think.
Yeah, you're dropping some gems right now. I love this.
I'm trying.
I love this. Well, you know what? Also, the thing is, because we've had conversations before, and especially in coaching sessions, like,
yeah,
this is such a wonderful opportunity for me because, like you said, you're such a good listener, and you've heard so much. But I wanted, you know, if I'm going to be, you know, candid about this, like, I'm so interested in what you do and how you do it because I found it so helpful. This is a wonderful experience to hear more about, you know, who you are and how you got here, and very impressive.
Thank you, brother. Now, I really enjoyed our time. And for anybody who would want to work with me, I don't show up like this in my sessions. It's a different human, but that human is intended to serve you best. So yeah, I'm glad that we found this time just to wrap, man. It's good.
Yeah, this is great. So another thing is that as you're looking at like what you've learned, and especially, well, before we go there, this Monday night, so in your Sunday when you start your week, right? So it's Sunday, you're getting organized, you're doing all those things. Is there a specific time frame you give yourself on Sunday? Is it like, hey, this is an hour block of work that I'm going to do to schedule my week?
2 to 3.
Yeah.
2 to 3 every Sunday. I got either, you know, it's March Madness, so that's what I had on last week, but I have a sports game on. So my 5-year can run around and enjoy that. But I try to get myself away so I can just focus. I put on some good music so the game is watching me while I'm got some music going, and I'm just thinking about all the pieces that I need to continue moving forward. It might be someone who wanted to follow up on some coaching or consulting. It might be a project that I just want to get off the ground, because if I don't make time to plan it, it's never going to get built. It stays an idea, and ideas that never get built turn into resentment. And I don't want to live a life of resentment. I want to live a life of, even if I tried it and it didn't work out, at least I know I have some data on why it didn't work out. So yeah, 2 to 3. And what I've learned is by 2:30, I'm done. Right. And then from 2:30 to 3, I'm kind of just fine tuning things, right? Maybe adding more clarity to the goals that I want to have. The Monday.com app allows you to add sort of urgency. So I can say something with high urgency, low urgency. And so I might just look about 2:30, look and say, wow, a lot of this stuff seems urgent. Well, if everything's urgent, nothing's urgent. So let me put some priorities here to make sure that things are scaled right for me. And then I'm calendaring, right? And then because I'm an entrepreneur, my wife is an entrepreneur, we have a shared calendar. I want to make sure she knows what my goals are, right? So we can communicate. And so I'm updating those family calendars, right? I'm making sure that I'm set up that so when I have opportunities like this, I can just be. And I don't have to worry about, okay, what's coming next? And this thing. No, because I already did that. I already did all that planning. So now I can just move. And that outboard motor, man, it's been amazing.
That's fantastic. Yeah, such good tips. So
yeah.
I want to make sure that we give you a moment here to reflect any parting words or anything, but I want to really focus on, if you could, the next few minutes of just like, what do you see holistically in whether it's the industry, nothing specific about specific clients, but what do you see in your sphere right now and where all of this is going in society and careers and jobs and personhood? Is there any themes that come out?
I think one thing that this is a great question. One of the things that we're never going to be able to escape, and we shouldn't try to, is transition. things are always changing. We have major conflicts happening all over the world that no longer stay in those spaces, even though the conflicts might be happening in those spaces. The outcomes and what people feel and how it nuances their life gets rippled all across our globe. We have that. We have the emergence of new technologies, right? Folks are saying that AI is one of the biggest advancements that we will ever see, whether it be in computing or any other industry. And so what does that mean for us? What does that mean for our jobs? What does it mean for our lives and livelihood? I think there's a lot of what we talk about in coaching: volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity out there in the world. And so when I'm meeting with clients, they're trying to navigate that. They may not have that you know, buttoned up language to say that's what it is, but that's what they're navigating. That's what we're all navigating. And so I love doing what I get to do because I get to walk alongside people as they're navigating that volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity in their scope, right? And giving them insights, well, helping them realize that they have natural insights, things that they're already many times doing, but just need to be reminded of or pointed to, that they can make an impact regardless of all of that volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. So that's what I'm seeing. I'm also seeing that folks are desiring to be more resilient after COVID. Like, people are coming out of COVID-19, and some people are coming out of COVID-19, and now with a different value set. They don't want to work as much as they have been working. Don't want to have the same types of constraints that the corporate world has given them. And they want to test and try out some new ways. We have a new generation coming into the workforce. They have different needs, and I'm experiencing clients who are trying to lead them well, right? And how to connect with them, and how to say no to some of their needs, because maybe some of them haven't heard no before. So it's those things. It's people realizing that transition is real and that they have agency in what that looks like for them. And that's what I really love about coaching.
Yeah, it's such a powerful space to be in when you're talking about walking alongside of people that are making these changes. And, you know, there's so much energy there, you know, when people are in that transition space and doing things, and to be alongside of that and to help guide. And to your initial point about this, is not necessarily give the answers, but help people clear things out of the way so they can see them in a clear sense.
That's the thing. I get giddy when I start seeing clients go, oh, like that oh moment is amazing, because it happens consistently, not in the same time frame. And when it happens, it's like, okay, you're not going to need me much longer, because you're starting to have more oh moments. Like, you're starting to see more clarity. And that's exactly what it is. Getting the roadblocks out of the way, or helping us see them differently, helping us language those roadblocks differently, so that they become opportunities and maybe stepping stones instead of roadblocks.
Yeah, that's huge. And especially because over the mountain, there's other mountains, right? So it's never going to, it's never going to like, oh, figured it out, I'm done. Like, there's always going to be opportunity for growth.
Yeah. If you're doing it right, you never arrive. That's my philosophy.
I love it. And so we'll end on that, 'cause I know we have a short time frame here. Coach Bobby Humes, thank you so much for joining. I will include your contact information and some of the other details that you shared in the show notes. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for your time and everything that you're doing.
Brother, thank you. Thanks for doing this. And I look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, bro.